This is a conversation. It's episode 141 with Michelle Grabner, Milwaukee-based artist and multi-hyphenate, as in she does it all in art and out. And we will get to all of that. Let me give you a little tip. Don't go to michellegrabner.com's website and check out all of her activity because it will kick your ass, and I don't want that to happen to you. Okay, because I care about you like that. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Michelle's work, some of the work that Michelle curated into the 2014 Whitney Biennial, a shot of her Milwaukee-based artist-run space, and an outdoor shot of her other artist-run space in more rural Wisconsin. And what else? A book that her artist-run space published as well. So check those out. The last episode we did was with millennial gallerist Emma Hanley of the Jack Hanley Gallery in the Lower East Side. Very interesting take into being a part of a very small team, relatively speaking, for a gallery. And what she does and what goes on there. A couple things, finally, before we get into that conversation with Michelle. One is that we do get into some of the thick of things regarding what became a controversy regarding the artist Donnell Wolford, who Michelle curated, the creation of the artist Joe Scanlon, who Michelle curated into her portion of the 2014 Whitney Biennial. And I had a podcast a while back, some of you may have heard it, with artist Margie Schnibbe, LA artist, and LA artist Carl Handel, who was in Michelle's portion of Biennial. And we were talking about the Biennial, and that came up for a moment, and I insisted that I didn't know enough about it and that we shouldn't get into it. And indeed, that was a good call, because Michelle was very, very involved in that situation, and she has a lot to say about it, and so you will hear that coming up. The other thing that I wanted to say quickly before we get in is, as this comes out, it is Memorial Day weekend 2016, and I noticed that in LA, both via emails and looking at one of the sites that tells you what shows are happening, that there are over a dozen shows opening on Saturday, and I'm very confused by that. I mean, I understand a few, but this many, I guess it's fine that the collectors aren't there, because collectors aren't going to be there, right? They're out of town. The collector class gets out of town at the drop of a hat. Am I wrong? I like to try to get out of town when I have the opportunity, long weekends do tend to be a big opportunity, because those are sometimes the only opportunities to take a vacation, you know, even if it's part of that weekend. So I don't know about you, but I wonder what you think about this whole let's do a bunch of openings when everybody's out of town thing. That's basically my angle on it. All right, enough angling for now. Let's get into the discussion with Michelle Grabner. Do stay tuned for the back end for some additional information. And thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you in the back end. So you're in Portland now, right? Is it a residency?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, a combination. Yeah, uh-huh. A combination of things. I am here because I have been working on curating and doing a lot of the organization for the 2016 Portland Biennial,
mm-hmm.
which is a statewide biennial. And then simultaneous, I am here by the participating in a residency at Bullseye Glass Company. It's mm-hmm. plate glass fusing, so it's kind of great. I get to work on projects. Glass is absolutely new to me, but also get some of the administrative work done, some of the prep work for opening up the biennial.
Wow. And I guess you've gotten a reputation as being a biennial person, apparently.
I'm getting that. Yeah, it's sticking.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me is that Well, first of all, let me just set this up by clarifying that you are based in Chicago, correct?
Well, no, actually not anymore. I teach in Chicago, so I am the Crown Family Professor of Painting at the School of the Art Institute. However, I am we live in Milwaukee now, and that's where we run our exhibition spaces, the Suburban, and then the Poor Farm, which is in central Wisconsin. But we just moved from Oak Park, first ring suburb of Chicago, after spending 17 years there, 18 years.
I wow.
Yeah. So I take the train into school. It's only 80 miles between Chicago and Milwaukee. So it's not terribly far, and there's a very civilized train that goes back and forth. So commuting is great, and I like Chicago much better now that I don't live there.
is that Amtrak then?
Yeah, it's the Hiawatha line.
Hiawatha. Wow, that's a great name for a train line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Why do you like Chicago more now that you don't live there?
Yeah, it's so interesting. So when I, you know, I'm usually down there one day a week teaching, working with my grad students, and, you know, walking around downtown, seeing the skyline, there's something where you can see its potential. When I was there, when I was living there, it felt like I was teaching all the time, or I had to always be in a kind of defensive mode. You know, I would leave the studio, leave the house, you know, and it's just difficult to navigate the city on a daily basis because it's big, it's compact, you know, it has wonderful diverse offerings, but it's just so difficult to be productive in a city that is so dreadfully big and condensed. And Milwaukee, you know, it has the same kind of footprint in terms of neighborhoods, the same kind of social problems, the same kind of, you know, interesting things that are happening on a cultural level, but I can navigate that city, you know, north side, south side, west side, east side, three times a day and still be back home to pick up my daughter and have a family dinner. So it's just high production in that city. So Chicago is great just because I can only take in its kind of great offerings and not have to kind of live into its, you know, big city problems.
Mm-hmm. Where are you from originally?
Wisconsin. So I've lived in Milwaukee before. So it's not it's a city that I spent most of the 80s in, most of the 90s, actually, till 1997 when we moved to Chicago. And I was born in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which is about 1.5 to 2 hours north of Milwaukee.
Mm, got it. Yeah. The reason I asked why where you're from, and so you're from kind of small town Wisconsin, is because when you were talking about how sort of big and unwielding Chicago is, I guess I wondered if you had, obviously you've spent a lot of time in New York from time to time, but you basically, as far as places you've lived, it's been throughout the Midwest, sounds like.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think about that all the time, that if, you know, it's something about the size of Milwaukee imprinted on me. So I came from the small town in northeastern Wisconsin, went to undergraduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and that was going to the big city, you know, despite it only being 2 hours away. But it's that kind of town that I think imprinted on me as a very young person. I think I was 17 when I went to college. So I gravitate to the St. Louis's, the Clevelands, the Indianapolis's, which are not, you know, they're cultural centers for these Midwestern states, mm-hmm. But they're not Chicago. You know, it's not they're not, you know, Milwaukee's not huge in the same way that Chicago is.
Right.
Or such a regional center. So I just am more productive. And I think, you know, outside of the kind of imprint that Milwaukee made in terms of my reach, it probably imprinted my sensibility to how I think about work, what I can get accomplished, you know, a relationship to, you know, the labor of life, the labor of the studio, you know, dealing with a family. So that, I think, you know, just has taken hold and shaped me in a way where Chicago always stretched me to, you know, degrees of discomfort.
Right. Interesting. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, as you were just describing sort of getting things done in a sense to just sort of shorten and maybe make more simplified what you were saying in that brief moment, I was thinking, yeah, that's great to be able to have a more productive lifestyle being outside of a sort of busy center where things tend to overwhelm you or, you know, complicate things, that kind of lifestyle. But at the same time, I was thinking if you are in a smaller or non-even art center, you know, how do you get on the radar? This, you know, you're sort of juggling or trying to reconcile those two things. One, you know, having the time to be productive, as productive as you can. And then the other is, well, but on the other hand, am I sacrificing kind of being on the radar or, you know, having the right networking? And obviously, if one looks at your activities, that hasn't been an issue. But I wonder if at times it's felt like it was.
Yeah, no, that really is the right thing to ask. And I understand that I could not, if I never left Milwaukee, I don't think it would be as fruitful. Right. So in terms of being in Chicago, which, you know, you're hearing me complain about in terms of it taking a kind of toll on how I think about production, how I think about time, it also put me into an arena where, you know, exchange and networking and, you know, various kinds of conversations had to happen, you know, thus opening up, you know, the suburban, a project space in Oak Park where we were bringing, you know, the world to us, whether there were artists coming from New Zealand or London or St. Louis, you know, it was we recognize that, you know, that to get out or to bring others in, to have a wide field of context is hugely important to our art careers. So I also think now being in Milwaukee when, you know, I'm spending time with some young artists who are just coming out of school there, you know, there is a kind of almost they have to get out. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to somebody who is from Milwaukee who went to grad school in Cranbrook, which is in Bloomfield Hills, just north of Detroit. And it was a group that came over to the suburban. It was the sculpture department from Cranbrook came over, and she was saying, and she was the one who reminded me of this. She's like, yeah, I'm from Milwaukee, and you're talking, you know, really interestingly about moving back there. You're very excited, Michelle, but, you know, you have to get out. And I think that's the case. And if you end up using Milwaukee as a home base and you haven't had other experiences in your life, living in other cities, other parts of the world, you know, you just have to actively be traveling. You have to have relationships to other cities. And I don't care if that's Portland or New York or Berlin, or Mönchengladbach, a small town in Europe. There, you really have to kind of move around and understand. And I think, you know, Michael, you know, that residencies are kind of the baseline for all young artists these days. Everybody's looking to get into residencies, and, you know, there's more of them than there ever was. So when I came out of school, like, it was an impossibility for me to participate in residencies because I had young kids, but there weren't that many of them. So I think the idea of the residency, or almost nearly fetishizing the idea of spending years after graduate school popping from one residency to another, is just that. It's kind of a system that provides you, you know, the opportunity to move about the world, to be in contact with other artists and develop this kind of network. So your question is absolutely the case. I would not be who I was if I'd never left Milwaukee. I had to leave Milwaukee to come back to a place like that.
Right.
And, you know, and I had to go to Chicago, quite honestly.
Right.
Chicago is, you know, culturally very vertical. And, you know, I learned a lot there. I had to work very hard there. But I also had to push at the institutions that, the very strong institutions that that are Chicago. You know, Milwaukee or smaller cities don't have that same kind of, you know, vertical, powerful institution that, you know, you have to kind of look at very carefully and watch its power and understand its influence the way you do in Chicago or New York or other cultural centers.
Mm. And meanwhile, making another city comparison or urban comparison, a past guest on this show who is an artist who was in Chicago for a number of years and then came to Los Angeles,
yep,
kind of made the case, a personal case anyway, that they had to get out of Chicago because, you know, it had its limitations. And I wonder, so it's all relative, obviously, but for you, it was, Chicago was kind of your New York in a way, and or your Los Angeles, or however you want to put it. But for this artist, Chicago was their Chicago, or Chicago was their Milwaukee,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, all that to say, and you can certainly comment on that, but I think the maybe the important question that, for me, that comes out of that is, what kind of conversations do you have with your students about that? I mean, are more of them sort of feeling like Chicago is their New York, or more of them feeling like New York is their New York?
Yeah, it varies, and it goes in waves too, because I've been at the Art Institute since 1996. I've been there, grad advising anyway, for quite some time. And, there were waves in the late 90s when I first started where everybody was going out to LA, whether that was Mari Eastman, who's now back in Chicago, or Rebecca Morris, who's still, in Los Angeles, and we would identify her now as an LA-based artist. And then there's waves of students who, go to New York. I would say that, it's shifted. There's lots of people going to Los Angeles right now. I have hordes of undergraduates who are going, not even applying to grad school, but going as a kind of community, sticking together, already talking about making a space when they land in Los Angeles. So I think, it depends on, what those swings indicate are, it's everything from relationship to the economy, what's going on in the art world and personal economies. We can parse that. I would also say that there is always a good deal. There's maybe another third. There's a third that kind of breaks off to the East Coast, a third that goes to the West Coast, and a third in this, I'm being very, I'm simplifying here, but a third that will stick around Chicago for a little while. They'll say they'll give Chicago 3 years. And then of that proportion of people who stay, some of them do stay quite a bit longer, and some of them will, eventually, head somewhere else, maybe Berlin or maybe New York. So it kind of breaks, and it has been kind of breaking into thirds, pretty evenly over my time there. But like I said, with some swings, a little more going to LA, more going to the East Coast at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, it's right now, I'm not even having these bigger conversations, like I am, in terms of, why LA now? Let's look at what's going on there. What kind of culture is out there? What are the sound bites from outside of LA that we're talking about? Same goes true with New York. After 2008, when, the economy tanked, we're all set for, New York to have to engage in a whole different way of thinking about work, about ideas, about economy, and it didn't. It doubled down. We all know this. It doubled down. So New York has not been a very great place to move if one is really one wants to engage in kind of a ground level ideas. Like, how do we deal with that? It's still the center of distribution. That's a reality. And for some people, that's where they need to go. They need to kind of plug themselves in. They need to get off the plane at LaGuardia and be handed a script. And that's what they want. And, I don't challenge that, based on who they are, based and the work they're making, that's very appropriate for them. I will say that if you are not, the script that you get in New York is very different than the script when you pull into Los Angeles. If you stay in a place like Chicago, or even head to a smaller place from Chicago to Milwaukee or to Cleveland, you as an artist are also responsible for extra work, and that extra work is coming to understand and articulate the criteria in which you need to succeed in that city, right? Because there is no script, quite honestly. You have to kind of piece it together, and it changes all the time. And some people, that's extra work that they're not very good at doing. It's just not, they would rather just be hunkering down and thinking about sculptural form or something.
Right.
But you really have to be kind of engaged in criticality, engaged in the idea of how, the social aspect, the social makeup at any given place, and so forth. So it's kind of a little bit more work, honestly. But I'm up for that only because, and I think a lot of people are, because, that's intriguing. They just see their kind of cultural work in a bigger context, and mm-hmm. want to pay attention to those other things that are shaping the context in which they're working.
Yeah. Well, I have a script that I would like you. I would like to do a little script doctoring to one of your scripts, if I may.
Yes,
and
yes,
that
please,
is,
please.
And that is to your Art Institute students. You should go to Cleveland or Milwaukee, and you should stay away from Los Angeles.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny because I was in LA not too long ago, maybe a year ago. I was brought in. Otis was doing an institutional review, and talking to a lot of friends out there, seeing some friends, and it's a funny thing. There's some suspicion in terms of like how much it can hold, and what's going on within the economy with the opening of all these New York galleries. What is that all about? And I know you talk about that and think about that too. I don't know. I'm stretched when I'm out there. And it always perplexed me. Like I can unravel New York and its logic much more than I can Los Angeles.
Yeah. The narrative I think that's been going on, at least was going on, say, 10 years ago, and is probably more complicated now. But let's say 10 years ago, the narrative was if you were in New York, you needed, and you were sort of getting a little burnout or things weren't really happening, you needed to go to LA because it was more friendly to artists and there were more opportunities. And now
right.
The reason I sort of gave you that script doctoring is because I feel like as many new galleries as there are many more artists. And so it's starting to feel a bit like the New York kind of saturation.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, there's just so many more artists, right? Everybody is a cultural producer of some sort. And, this is where I'm very happy to be mid-career, middle-aged by the fact that I don't know. It's so much more competitive no matter where you go, including Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. There's young artists everywhere. And, what we're not doing is talking about that is a critical, like what's happening there? I mean, are we all, what are our expectations? What's the criteria for which we're all going to succeed? Are we all, going for the same cookie? It's a funny thing. There's an artist in Milwaukee who lived in New York for quite some time. He lived in Europe as well. He was lamentful that, I was moving back to Milwaukee now because I was bringing this New York sensibility to his town. And I don't quite know what that means outside of a relationship to an economic value structure, I've never lived in New York. So I don't quite know what that means, but I do think it's about saturation, exactly what you're saying. There's just so many artists. I think it was code for, we just don't need another artist here, regardless of the sensibility. Yeah.
So going back to, what is the conversation what kind of things are, what kind of expectations, as you put it, people are having? What are you getting? Because you're boots on the ground with your students, I would think, and doing all of these panels and whatnot more than I am. So my sense from more or less the outside would be to say that everybody's expectations generally are too great for what's out there.
Yeah. 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 I'm having a really hard time I can tell you this by the fact that I'm in the process of finishing a longer essay on Leap Before You Look, the Helen Molesworth's Black Mountain College exhibition. And I'm writing this for Extra, Los Angeles Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And, here's an interesting opportunity. Everybody loves that show. Everybody I talk to swoons when they talk about the loom that was included in the exhibition or all of the photographic archives. I kind of thought an exhibition that's not particularly strong with the work it shows, even though these are amazing artists that went through the college. There was, if you think about Black Mountain College, rural South America, rural South in America, really embracing progressive education, something that, we don't see much of. I think if you're affluent, you can send your kids to Montessori or Waldorf or some kind of progressive form. But for the most part, we know that education, be it public middle schools or even, university systems are under a kind of assault right now. Trying to think about an exhibition like that and taking on understanding its conditions, where it came from. It wasn't just some kind of magical moment. You can actually dissect it and understand the influence of the European immigrant who came in to embrace this pedagogical structure, progressive structure, and then experimentation, right? So you had all of this thing happening post-war. It's pretty interesting. So I guess it would be interesting now to think about, where are we in terms of thinking about, cultural work, the individual within our conditions, the conditions that we live in now, and how can we I don't know, you know, how can we trigger these little moments that, you know, something else can happen, something interesting can happen outside of, you know, the economy, which, you know, ebbs and flows. So I don't, you know, the question that you're asking, I think I'm dodging it, Michael. I don't know. I mean, at no other time, you know, theory doesn't work, right? There's no one theory in which we can, you know, push at, you know, unravel, disentangle, you know, support, you know, that doesn't work. You know, I guess, I keep going back to the things and the images that we're making right now as a clue. And, you know, since 9/11, you know, we have been really engaged in, you know, the affect, that pre-symbolic, you know, pull, how we feel something, right? And trusting that wholly and seeing that played out, seeing that, that hot mess, that, that feeling played out in everything from social networking to the objects we make. You know, think about Sterling Ruby's basins or something like that. So we feel these things. But, you know, I think we're coming to a funny point, and we can all feel, right? So I think this gives us, it gives everybody an opportunity to participate, and because we're all feeling. So whether we're all feeling, does that make us cultural workers? Does that make us artists? Maybe. I think that has created a great, almost overpopulated field of people who are participating, you know, as curators, as artists. But, you know, I think we're hitting a crucial point, and I don't think it has, I'm not quite sure how the economy overlays in this, but you know, we're seeing, I'm seeing a lot of work that's dealing with psychologies, and I haven't seen that before. And we can see a new interest in surrealism, and actually, you know, surrealist scholars in art history. I mean, surrealism was, you know, kind of the laughing joke of all art history departments because it was just dully and soft. And we're starting to see really interesting scholarship come out of surrealism again. The Chicago Imagists, which always dealt with a kind of psychology, they're, you know, we're looking at them in interesting ways. And I think I'm optimistic by all of this, by the fact that, you know, instead of just being pulled, you know, through a kind of affect, a material affect, that we're actually thinking through things. We're starting to, you know, psychology is a way of understanding the thinking. So I think that's very good. How that's going to play out in, you know, the bigger field, these questions you're asking, these, you know, many students that, you know, the School of the Art Institute puts out with MFAs every year. You know, I don't know, but I do think there's some optimism in terms of, you know, stepping back a little bit and being analytical. You know, the body is nothing more, you know, the body is both feeling, but it's also, you know, thinking. And to be analytical, I hope we get to that point. And, you know, yes, what you're hearing is a lot of verbiage to get to the point where we need to be more critical. And maybe criticality will also, you know, make the field more difficult and less saturated. I'm not sure. But anyways, this is how I'm thinking. Long way around the barn. So the psychologies, the questions you're asking, and to have everybody think them through and to again, be somewhat analytical about, you know, bigger pictures, but also, you know, what they're doing. How do they think about their participation?
So I think maybe one takeaway, if I can sort of try to boil it down from what you were saying, and you can redirect me or revise what I'm picking up, is that I'm going to read in that you're somehow arguing for a more thoughtful approach to one's work as opposed to a more market-driven approach, which is a little bit more fetishistic and whatnot. Am I somewhere in the right ballpark?
Yeah, no, that's the perfect synthesis. It makes me sound so simple, but that is the case. Yes, that is one case. It's this Janus-based, you know, and again, I'm careful about, you know, I'm not, the economy is a real thing, right? And I am always of the belief where, you know, as many people should suck off the tit of the art economy when it's flush as possible. Everybody should get a little piece of it. So I'm not, you know, I'm not antagonistic to it. It's an absolute reality. But that reality shifts, right? And I think that if we get so used to, you know, kind of one measure, one criteria, you know, that becomes confusing. You know, the other side of the free market is this, and I've been saying this for a while, and we all know that. The other side of the free market is that, you know, it opened up what how people can contribute, just in terms of, you know, what kind of form, what kind of material, what kind of genre and media can come forward, right? You know, what was it, the show at Barbara Gladstone about ceramics, I wrote about that for Extra in 2004, and it was unheard of. Who had ceramic shows in Chelsea? And all of a sudden, you know, ceramics, you can't escape it. Every great artist is, you know, has a kiln in the basement,
right?
And that is free market. I mean, that's kind of a loosening up of, you know, both experimental form, right? But also, you know, allowing these things, these objects to be able to circulate. So it's just kind of, it did some really interesting things in terms of, you know, experimentation, opening things up. But what hasn't caught up with the free market, what doesn't, you know, it behooves, it's not something that's embraced, is like slowing down and analyzing that thing. Right? Mm. Is that really a great pot? Is that pot, you know, any more interesting than hold it up against the Ken Price and what's going on here? Or is it just, you know, so there's not, nobody's slowing down and giving language and discourse, you know, to this, to the gesture of, you know, moving, you know, into or slipping back and forth between these experimental forms, or even what does experiment mean here and now, and how do these artifacts go out into the world, and how do they circulate? That's different than, you know, I don't know, a hard edge painting or something, abstraction. You were very succinct in what I'm saying, but I think there's nuances in both the, you know, if one starts looking at the economy or if one starts looking at experimentation, it's trickier. It's that would be simple, but I think it's trickier than that.
I think that ceramics example is a perfect example, because sort of loosely off the top of my head, I can think of so many group shows or just ceramic, you know, solo shows of ceramics where the work does kind of fall into this, it's just so, you know, it's just so great. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just so, you know, this sort of vague territory. And the reason it's sort of immune to certain criticality is because it's sort of this second wave of, you know, of ceramics, where it's the first wave being one where it was maybe like, what the hell, you know, with the ceramics. And this one is just somehow it's a trend and people are buying into it. So, but without diving further into that, one of the things I wanted to pick up on and what you were saying before is, speaking of, I think the way you put it was sort of sucking on the teat that comes your way when you have that opportunity, is I guess it's a great, potentially good segue to my sense of your trajectory. And this is going to be, speaking of simplistic, this is going to be a very simplistic one, and it might parallel nicely with our mutual colleague Stephen Westfall, who I simplified sort of what I thought the vision of his career was. But basically, I'm going to sort of describe it this way: is that you have been an abstract painter, and, you know, as well as a teacher and a curator, you know, slash artist-run gallery curator for a while, and sort of were garnering, you know, sort of insider respect for a number of years. And then you, just a couple of years ago, became one of the Whitney Biennial curators, and your work, if there wasn't sort of a gold rush before then, really kind of hit that sweet spot. And I wonder if that, to what extent that's close to the case in your experience.
Yeah, no, it's still kind of mysterious to me. That is the case. I mean, when I took on the Whitney Biennial project, you know, I didn't kind of know which way, you know, that kind of, what would it be, subtext, my own studio practice would break, that, you know, maybe nobody, you know, the work that I did was going to fall away, that, you know, that she is a studio-based artist was not going to be interesting, that I would be known, my narrative would be that of a curator, and I would have to work extra hard to remind people, work extra hard in terms of getting my work out there, having conversations with the people who've, you know, been representing my work for a while. Or maybe it was going to be a good thing. Like, I didn't know. I mean, and I think I like to think that I have a kind of good understanding, at least an instinctual understanding of how that was going to break. But I didn't. I really didn't know what was going to happen. But it did happen. But it also came at a point where, and I think this was circumstantial, I had a survey exhibition at Museum of Contemporary Art in Cleveland, a brand new, beautiful building, really big, fresh show, big, beautiful catalog. So that opened, I want to say, in November 2013 and went into 14, and then the biennial kind of opened immediately after. So there was this kind of other push that, you know, this biennial was getting, my survey show was getting a lot of attention. So it kind of worked as a way, kind of perfect way of like pointing out or reminding people that, yes, the biennial is coming up. Yes, it's being curated by these three curators. One of them is an artist, and this artist has a survey show, which means that I've been working for 25 years, and here's a scope of that work. So I think that introduced me to Jim Cohan, who has a lot of relationships with Cleveland and the art world in Cleveland. So I was able to work with him, and, you know, he's done me really well in terms of the New York Gallery. I have not had a New York Gallery since 10 in 1 Gallery, which was in Chicago and moved to New York and closed in 03, I think 03 or maybe 02. That's meaningful. Jim Cohan, that gallery is pretty terrific in terms of their relationship with institutions, which, as we know, as artists, is important. And there was all kinds of, you know, kind of critical blowout from that first exhibition because of the Ken Johnson review, but that may be another story. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it just comes down to the fact that I didn't even have a kind of a gut feeling about what the biennial would do to, my own narrative as an artist, if it was going to kind of sink it or if it was going to, you know, rise. I'm happy to say that it didn't hurt.
Right.
I'll be modest, yeah.
But it was Cohan. That Cohan sort of picked you up based on the Museum of Contemporary Art Cleveland show. Is that right? More than the biennial?
Yeah, no. I think it was a combination. My curator for the MOPA show in Cleveland is David Knorr. David actually now left the museum and is a director at Cohan. He mostly based at their Lower East Side gallery space, does a lot of curating there now. But I think it had to do with his relationship with David's relationship with Jim. And, you know, that's how we know perfectly well. That's how the world works, right? It works both up close, right? These personal handshakes, these people that we go to again and again because we learn to work with them. We trust them. And it goes way back, from these kind of very distant, curator, Whitney Biennial, all these big signifiers kind of coming together. So, how things actually happen, I think, is a combination of these interpersonal relationships to, these kind of, big, sometimes misunderstood narratives about influence within the art world. And in this case, it was the Whitney Biennial.
Right. I would really love to kind of look at that whole arc if it's not something that you've done a million times already. I'll only set it up by saying that, correct me if I'm wrong, you are the first artist curator of the Whitney Biennial.
Yeah. So, and that's on a funny scale too. So I would say that, early on, Miss Vanderbilt herself, there was some art making going on, started herself as an artist. So that goes right back to, the beginnings, not of the biennial, but of the museum itself. Mm-hmm. So I was reminded of that in taking on this position. But then also Anthony Elms, who, I knew for some time. He was based in Chicago before he took on the curator position at the ICA in Philadelphia. And, Anthony is a kind of artist as well. He's not an exhibiting artist, and I wouldn't say that his, first narrative is being an artist. I mean, he gets a check for liberating, a paycheck. So, you know, he is kind of an archival artist, maybe we'd say that. So, but yeah, in terms of somebody who's really, you know, whose whole life is structured around being an artist, sure, I guess that would be a yes to be one of the first curators to deal with the pain and the pleasure of being an artist. Yeah,
a yes with an incredibly long caveat. Got it.
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, you know what? This is funny because I'm telling you this only because. The answer should have been yes, I am the first artist to curate it. But it was funny because when I was working with the institution, that being the Whitney, it's a funny thing. Institutions don't like to be declarative. So there was, it was drummed into me. What I just told you, this long arc of, of relationship to artists and curators was kind of conditioned by the institution. So I guess it was a caveat or a default, but it was that it's more the institution, the Whitney, who, reminded me this is how I have to present that than I think the truth that I have in my understanding.
Right. Well, talk about how it came about. I mean, did it simply start with kind of a phone call or an email and that was pretty much when you knew, or was it much more a series of complicated exchanges?
Let's see. No, it was an email. So Elizabeth Sussman and Jay Sanders, who were responsible for the 2012 Whitney Biennial, took on the job of trying to figure out how they would shape the 2014 Biennial. And, there was a lot of things in play at that time. And I think one of the things that they were interested in is reaching out to curators who weren't based in New York. As I've said many times, and as you know perfectly well, the biennial, the curators, are always coming from, New York for the most part. They have a relationship with New York. So they kind of wanted to break that up. And again, understanding that this would be the last biennial in the Breuer building on the Upper East Side. Mm-hmm. So they were, I think they were kind of more far reaching than they would be otherwise, that they could think differently about the 2014 biennial. So I got an email from Jay actually asking if I would be interested in writing a narrative about how I would go about thinking about organizing being a curator. So I wrote up a one page rationale, maybe, to the point where I included some of the artists I would think about. If it was, this must have been August, when was it, 2012, so it would have been after the biennial close, so it must have been August 2012, and things change, but I thought, well, I'm going to be honest, and this artist I'm interested in as an example of my thinking, and it may really sink my language, right? I mean, we could all be a little ambiguous about how we would shape up the idea of a biennial in contemporary art, but I thought I was just going to lay out a list of artists that are interesting to me and would maybe help illustrate my ideas. Mm-hmm. And then after I submitted that, I had a Skype conversation with Jay and Elizabeth, and then they were talking to other people, obviously, and then I want to say it was November, late October, November, that they contacted me and asked me, invited me to do that. And then we met for the first time. Like I said, I knew Anthony from Chicago. Never met Stuart. Stuart was in London then. During the process of the biennial, Stuart took a position at MoMA. So he was based in New York during half, at least, of the biennial. So I think it was December of 2012. That we all kind of sat down and, started slogging it out.
But you each had your own floor, so to what extent did you have to compare notes as things were going along versus, I'm going to do my thing and you're going to do your thing?
Right. At that very first meeting that we had, we basically just had cocktails, sat down for cocktails. And I remember, I believe it was both Jay and Elizabeth and some curatorial assistants. I'm a little fuzzy on this. There was this, the idea that it already came out when they announced who the three curators would be. Donna DeSalvo said that it was going to be a layer cake affair, right, where we would each get our own floor. And so we all sat down together, and I believe it was Elizabeth who said, Elizabeth Sussman said that, if you wanted to just co-curate it, that's fine too. If you didn't like this, organizational conceit of each taking a floor. And we all talked about it. I was pretty interested in continuing that we would each curate a floor only by the fact that it would do something interesting in terms of bringing curation and putting that more clearly on view, the idea of selection, the idea of exclusion, inclusion, and so forth. Three different biennials in one, right? Three different, very different people, different you know, relationships to the art world. That could all be, visible, offered to the public. So I was really pushing for it. I was hoping that at that very first meeting, we were told what floor we would get, what our budget would be, and that wasn't the case. I think smartly now, the museum said, okay, you work it out. So, there was some negotiation in terms of who got what floor. I was, pretty adamant about wanting to engage the fourth floor because I was going to show large scale painting. I knew that early on.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that floor, just has much more exhibition space. Anthony said he was happy to take the second floor, which is, truncated by the theater. So I gave him a big portion of the fourth floor for Zoe Leonard's Camera Obscura. So there was give and take going on, throughout. We were talking about artists that we were interested in. There was a lot of redundant artists. I had people on my list that Stuart had on his list, that Anthony had on his list. And then we talked about what that would mean. I thought that would be interesting in terms of, different contexts. What, one artist would look like on the fourth floor would maybe feel very different on the second floor. In the end, that didn't happen. We didn't, artists were represented, but nobody was, included twice. So those kind of conversations we would meet and have coffee and kind of, talk about how we were moving forward, how we were thinking about our lists. In the end, I would have to say that there was not, we were all working independently about the layout of the floor, the language, our catalog entries, and so forth. So, we weren't sick of each other because we weren't seeing each other that much, but just enough to kind of check in to get a sense of, the arc of our projects, of our floors.
Mm. On the front end, we can talk, I think we can divide it into the sort of the front end and the back end of the show. So on the front end, on the front end, I don't know if you want to mention some of the names that you had on that initial proposal, that's up to you, but I would love to get a sense of, how imposing a assignment that became for you and to what extent you were cognizant of the power that you were sort of wielding in these selections that you're going to be making.
The power. I will give you a little anecdote. I teach a class in New York City every January. I've been doing this for now 8-9 years, and it's a study trip class. So, the class is 20 students, more than half of them are grad students or some undergrads. And, we go to the Art Forum office to talk to my editor. We go talk to curators. We talk into dealers and gallerists, and we do a lot of studio visits. And it was funny because when I was teaching in 2013, sometimes we'll go back to the same studio just because, artists are really good. They have great studios, first of all, that they can, accommodate all 20 students. But it was funny because I just remember thinking, gosh, everybody's nervous this year. I couldn't figure it out, right? Nobody was, we've been to their studios for 5 years consecutively, and all of a sudden they're all odd and weird and kind of goofy in the studio. And, I'm slow because it took me a couple days to realize, they're having a biennial studio visit I am in their studio and it's freaking them out. And they have to be cautious. And so it was this funny thing where you forget that, or I forget that anyways. I'm not, I just assume that we're, especially as artists, we're all coming from the same place, a point of passion, an interest in, ideas and materiality and so forth. And I forget that this is so meaningful. And it's ridiculous that I do this. This is where I'm very simple, because I've had biennial curators in my studio too, and kind of walk down and get nervous and understand how, meaningful this will be. And, the inclusion and what the promise of being included in the biennial, could be, which, as we know, I need to say this now, is not, that's just made up, this promise of great success that will come from being in the biennial. It's kind of bullshit.
It's a very mixed
but
bag.
We still perpetuate that, right? I mean, I tell you, it's still, still the case. So it's, Yeah, I mean, that wasn't my favorite part of the biennial. The making artists uncomfortable, that's the last thing I want to do.
Yeah.
Because I know how miserable it is as an artist myself.
Did they say anything to you, Michelle? Like, any of them? Was there any either, obviously, I would imagine not explicit, but were there any kind of implicit, reference made in any cases of the studio visits you did, whether with your tour or otherwise?
Yeah, it was very clear. Thanks for bringing that up. I am very clear, or still am to this day, if I am contracted to curate an exhibition, whether that's the Whitney Biennial or the Portland Biennial or an upcoming international exhibition, I reach out to artists and say, I would love to come by your studio. I am doing research on the Whitney Biennial. Mm-hmm. To make it very clear, in the past, it's always a little ambiguous and wishy-washy, and, everybody maybe knows who the curators are. They're coming to town. You hear from them. You piece it together, but there's no kind of explicit, I am coming to do a studio visit to do research for this project I am working on. It always drove me a little nuts. I always make it very clear about why I'm there. It's the truth of the matter. Most people would know whether I told them or not if I'm coming to do a studio visit and it's been announced that I'm, one of three curators for the biennial. I think to be as transparent as possible is my goal, just because as an artist, I need that.
Yeah. And speaking of being transparent, when on the back at the end of the visit, I'm going to kind of analogize you with a casting agent, and I'm going to say, we'll let you know, or no, probably you probably said something more like, I'll keep you posted, or I don't know, no promises, or, I'll update you at some point.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I thank them, and ideally, my goal also, my goal is that, that knowing my way around studios and knowing my way around ideas, whether I'm sharp with those ideas or not, but having a really kind of fruitful 1 hour, right? Being able to have an exchange with an artist, about ideas, about these things that we're talking about, that in it of itself is valuable, and that, you're in or you're out is not, that will come down the line, but that 1 hour, that conversation, that studio visit is rich, just in terms of an exchange, just in terms of a dialogue, just hearing somebody's language, thinking about, learning from them and maybe learning from me, so making that valuable and not just, a measure of I'm in or I'm out. Mm-hmm. So then I would thank them and say, this is the process. The goal is to I'll have my selection by, the end of October. You would be hearing from me by so-and-so. So again, trying to be as transparent with the information that I knew.
Right.
And then I had to ask that I wanted to get back to people that I wasn't going to be including. And I asked the museum, if that it was fine, I'm going to reach out to them now and say, here's my list. This is who I'm going to include. And I said, here's the list of those I'm not going to include. I'm going to get back to them. And there was a lot of hemming and hawing about that process. That hasn't happened before. Mm-hmm. Everybody who's listening, who has had visits from biennial curators in the past, they can kind of figure it out. If they haven't heard anything and, they know that, the list is going to be released soon in the New York Times, they're unlikely to be in it. But they didn't hear that from the curator who visited them or the curators. So I did get back to everybody and told them that, unfortunately, I'm not going to be including you, but maybe we can work together in the future, one of those emails. But again, I thought it was important and respectful for artists.
Yeah.
To hear it from me and not catch it in the paper.
Yeah, absolutely. And of the people, let's say that you had 100 studio visits, just to make it an even number, and you chose 25 artists that you wanted to be in the biennial. How many, you can use a fictional number, but how many of those 25 were you able to get approved and then went into the show?
Get approved in terms of the museum approving?
Your co-curators.
Oh, I see. I don't think there was only, we could, they, we weren't we didn't have to run this list by anybody. You know, we kind of honed in on, you know, who we wanted to represent, you know, our floor, how we wanted to include them. You know, and so, yeah, I would say that there were a couple artists that I had conversations about with Elizabeth Sussman and Jay Sanders. And again, both, you know, institutional curators. They are, you know, embedded in the Whitney. So, you know, we, you know, I don't want to say justified, but we had to give a kind of context for why we were putting these artists forward. And in some cases, you know, I would say I was challenged on a couple of them. That the curators, you know, Jay or Elizabeth or others from the Whitney were a little confused about why I would be thinking about that person. And in some cases, I fought hard to keep that person in play. And sometimes it was like, well, let me think more about that and think about the group, you know, think about curating, right? How I'm going to represent the ideas I want represented. So I can tell you that there, I did visit, I don't remember, let's say 130 studios for the Whitney Biennial, and then I included 53. So there was a high percentage of artists that I did include.
With a statute of limitations in place, are there any anecdotes in cases of artists that you defended or anything along those lines that you can share, or is it all pretty confidential?
Well, I can. I think we should talk about the, you know, the still, I don't, maybe it's not controversial anymore. I think it is for some people. The inclusion of Donnell Wolford. She is the fictional African-American female artist who is invented by two artists. One, Joe Scanlon. He is a New York-based artist. And the woman who played Donnell Wolford, who acted, the actor, Jennifer. So there was, when I wanted to include Donnell, I want to say it was Elizabeth Sussman again. Somebody at the museum said, can you please talk to Selma Goldman about this? You know, check this out. You know, this is a hot, you know, this is, you know, race right now is confusing. This is a project that is, you know, supposed to push at issues around race. You know, talk to Selma, and I said, I didn't know Selma. I don't have any relationship with her. But I talked to an African-American art historian at Northwestern about this project who has, you know, written about the Donnell project. He's kind of uninterested in it, didn't think it was great. But the museum, I guess what I'm saying is that the museum wanted to kind of vet this one,
right,
just to make sure it wasn't going to be purely controversial. And I totally support the institution's caution by the fact that they didn't want Biennial and all the work and all the other artists included to be subsumed by this controversy. You know, that, you know, there's with 103 artists total in the Biennial, that, you know, it would be a shame that if it opened up and the only thing that was being talked about was this inclusion of a fictional African-American artist named Donnell Wolford. So I understand their caution with that. So we talked a little bit. I talked to some other people. They seemed okay. Go ahead with it. And it was fine. Fine until
till the show.
April. That shit hit the fan. So it went on, you know, it went off without a hitch. And then then it kind of dissolved. And I still stand behind the inclusion of Donnell. I mean, you know, this is how we talk about these things. You know, my understanding of, you know, what happened, what transpired, you know, on a kind of a nearly factual basis is not the truth of how other people saw it. And I respect that, you know, my truth is not somebody else's understanding of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that nobody wanted to know that. It's interesting. I've learned a lot of, from this project, but again, like I said, I would include Donnell again because I think it's an important conversation we need to have in the art world. And, you know, if it has to be presented in, you know, a problematic, you know, in a project that got a lot of heat, a lot of heat, institutional heat, you know, that's okay with me.
Right. And without getting into all of that heat, if we could just focus on two parts of it, one being that, and this is just my sort of distant take on it, is that Joe Scanlon received a lot of critical verbiage in reports about the show. And so I guess I want to ask if that is correct. And secondly, did he soak up any or a fair amount of critical skepticism that that you might have had directed at you because it was directed directly at him as opposed to the curator?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I have to. It's in Joe's defense. It was getting to be. Let's see. The show opened up in March. It was coming to be April, and Joe approached me and the educational department at the Whitney and said, you know, let's do a panel discussion around this. Like nobody was biting on this. Nobody cared. Nobody, you know, there was not any discussion in the initial press that came out around the opening of the biennial. You know, a couple weeks passed, still nothing. And then the museum, basically, the Whitney just was like, nah, let's not open up this can of worms. But Joe actually, again, wanted a conversation around this. Now, you know, I believe in, Joe's complicated. He's a complicated artist. And I believe he really wanted to have a conversation around issues of race in the art world, conversations around authorship in the art world, but also thinking about, where it can break, when it becomes, the interest in controversy. Can that even happen in the contemporary art world? So I think he's interested in all of those aspects plus more. And like I said, the museum didn't want it. They're just like, nope, we made it this far. You know, it'll potentially, you know, the show will close and it will, nothing will happen. but that wasn't how it played out.
Maybe 2 weeks if after, only for them.
Joe was asking for controlling the discourse. It blew up publicly. Joe wasn't surprised. He did take it. But Joe is, this is not the first time that the Nell Wolford Project has had some pushback. This is just the most kind of public, just by the fact that she was in the biennial, gave it a greater platform.
Oh, Donnell Wolford had a life prior to the biennial?
Oh, yeah, she did. She's been around for a long time. If you go to Joe's website, Things That Fall, I believe the Donnell Project, that she has, she's a true fictional character, but she, has a timeline in terms of when she went to school. She was represented by a gallery in New York for many years. Joe was always complaining that, Donnell has a commercial gallery in New York, but I do not. So she's been around for quite some time. She was not, a project that Joe invented for the biennial, but somebody right. that I talked to Joe about. A matter of fact, Joe was the first artist that I visited in terms of my studio visits, and I was hoping that Joe would be in the biennial as well as Donnell Wolford. And Joe was the only artist who turned me down and said, I think it would be more interesting if it was just Donnell.
And it was just Donnell. Is that right?
It was. Yeah. That's
Got
right.
it.
That's
Got
exactly
it.
Right. Yeah.
Got it. Wow. there's so many questions. I'm just going to, because we could go on about that for a long time, but I'm just going to leave it at one question, and that is that my sense, again, way outside sort of the heat of the center of it, is that people were, maybe heard about that performance group, if I'm remembering right, that left the show in protest. But basically, they heard some version about this character, were offended, and then people sort of jumped on that bandwagon of being offended without really taking much time to look into what was actually going on.
Yeah, that's right. It was an interesting group. It's how do you say Yemen in Africa? Mm-hmm. And it was Sienna Shields is the person that I did a studio visit with in Dumbo, if I recall. And I kind of invited her right off if she would participate in my film and video program. And she was excited and said, and I said, it's shorts. This is not, I don't feel terribly strong in, my film and video world. But I get the theater and I would like to, show a handful of shorts by artists. And she asked me kind of immediately if she could, convene, a bunch of artists, a bunch of performers, a bunch of musicians together. And I said, take this, do what you want, in terms of developing a piece, and as far as I was concerned, a short was under 5 minutes. And, Yeah, so she developed something, but it wasn't a short. It was a 60-minute opus. And so we had to make accommodations for that, which the museum, again, was accommodating, as was I. And, you know, when the list of artists came out, you know, this group, you know, saw the list. They understood who their colleagues in the biennial were. But only after the opening did they come to understand. It was a kind of a slow learning curve for them in terms of what Dinel was as a project. They were upset that Dinel got wall space. There were two works, paintings, they're referred to as paintings, or actually collages on canvas support, by Dinel on the fourth floor. And that was that upset the collective because they wanted wall space. And, you know, so there was a lot of misunderstandings along the way. And I you know, I take that on fully. You know, I probably should have been in, you know, more careful conversation with Sienna and the collective in terms of how they, what their expectations were. So I think some of their pushback came from feeling that because they were in the film and video program and that they didn't have, you know, an ongoing presence during the run of the biennial, because we all had to share the theater. So therefore, you know, it was a third of the time where their video could be shown. That kind of spurned them to start, you know, kind of pushing back at some things, you know, the institution, but certainly their discovery of this fictional, you know, black female artist who was included in the biennial.
Right.
So yes, that's kind of how that came into the public consciousness.
Do you feel like you and that group have reconciled things to remain amiable, or what is your sense?
No, I think Sienna is still profoundly. I can't say still. I would say that, you know, during the run of the biennial and maybe even into the summer, you know, she was still very angry at me, and, you know, would, you know, ring up and let me know that. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure where they're at now. I say that, you know, in kind of disappointment, but also, you know, understanding of where we're at as a society, as a culture. And that is goes back to what I was talking about in terms of affect. You know, it was hot. We felt it. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of, you know, it was palpable, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, where is that now? And, you know, we're not good at, as a culture, unfortunately, we're not good at kind of doing the boring stuff of making change. You know, this kind of constant, you know, long-term, it's a long-term project, right? I mean, civil rights alone took, you know, many, 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 many years. And some people weren't, you know, didn't live to see it through. And, you know, that's, I'm always very conscious and very critical of that, you know, we can be hot and bothered for a little bit and then, you know, we're distracted and something else happens. You know, so I think, you know, it's unfortunate that there's not a continuous kind of negotiation of, you know, something as, you know, fundamental as representation in the art world.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it gets, you know, it gets boring and tedious, but we don't really stick that card out. We like when we can feel it and can be angry, you know, can feel it in our bodies. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that stuck out for me when you were describing the process of doing studio visits that I wanted to revisit it before we maybe get to the back end of the show, which we still haven't gotten to, ironically, is when you described how important that hour visit was in terms of exchange of ideas and getting a sense of what the artist was thinking about, is how you balance their vision in terms of their articulation of their vision and what have you, as compared with the work itself. In other words, how often was the battle won for you through the studio visit and the sort of conversation that you had versus, you know, you go in there and you see the work and you kind of have a sense right away of whether this is definitely a candidate.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you know, I would say that that's where all the work is located, right? In terms of being in the studio, being very excited, thinking that there's a place immediately in terms of how I'm shaping, you know, my ideas around the biennial. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, you know, stepping back and kind of, you know, looking at those ideas again and thinking that, oh, but I was in that other studio and it didn't, you know, it didn't dawn on me that this would be something important in terms of thinking about, you know, abstract painting or thinking about, you know, criticality in a lot of the work that I showed. And it comes to the fore. So that's, you know, it's a constantly, you're kind of molding it. You start these studio visits, you start shaping something. You know, I have to say that when I was doing the West Coast tour, I landed in San Diego and, you know, for a couple months in the summer, you know, drove all the way up to Seattle doing studio visits along the way. And, you know, that kind of first foray into this, stepping into the studio visits of the biennial, I was kind of hoping that, you know, something would announce itself. There would be a thematic, something that would come forward that I could start using as an organizing structure for the biennial. And quite honestly, nothing did. You know, there was, you know, lots of interesting work, but it wasn't, there wasn't anything kind of cohesive about one studio to another studio from one conversation with an artist to another. So, you know, I realized that I wasn't going to find it, that I actually had to overlay it. So, you know, overlaying ideas, and I ended up landing on three organizing frames, you know, one being, you know, criticality and language, one being the other to that, and that would be affect, you know, materiality and craft. And then the third was a concentrated look on, you know, abstract painting by women, something that, you know, is close to me, something that I think about a lot, and something maybe, you know, maybe more personal, I should say. Mm-hmm. And using those kind of three ideas to create a biennial. So the process of, you know, being in studios, it's never clear when I'm there. I can get very excited about something, have a great conversation, but that didn't necessarily yield, you know, that artist inclusion in the biennial.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the back end then. So, or the middle / back end. And I guess my first question is whether you decided that you would ignore the publicity around the show, or whether you were just going to embrace it, or, you know, and to what extent it's kind of unavoidable because people are always thrusting every new review in your face or something like that.
Yeah. No, it's, again, it's, you know, my slowness, I suppose. You know, I understand and, you know, have watched and desired to participate in biennials in the past, as I expressed. You know, I think my first biennial was in the early 90s. So, you know, I've been watching them like all artists watch, and we, you know, give Whitney biennials, you know, too much influence, I think. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's just how it is. That when the curators were announced, I knew that there would be a flurry about who's that and why are these people doing that, and, you know, trying to figure out the institutional choice in bringing on Stuart and Anthony and an artist from the Midwest. And but then once the biennial opened, I naively just assumed that critics would start to use the biennial as a way of thinking about what's being made, who's participating, who's interesting, which work is compelling. You know, and that's done very little, hardly at all. I mean, it's still around, you know, these big kind of institutional ideas. It's about the Whitney Biennial itself. And to some degree, it's very frustrating, you know, being somebody who does write criticism, you know, taking on the biennial as a structure as opposed to the artwork in it. And I just, you know, I was disappointed. I invited 53 artists, all of who I think are fabulous and, you know, deserve some kind of criticality. They didn't have to, you know, critics didn't have to love it all, but I was hoping that, you know, the critical shift would land on the artists. And then, you know, from the work that was included, whether that was on Anthony's floor or Stuart's floor, that, you know, some kind of discussion, some kind of discourse around, you know, what's happening in 2014 would emerge. But, you know, it's just too, it's that's a lot of work for critics. And maybe critics aren't, you know, I don't know if it's a laziness or it's just the bigger fish to look at as the biennial itself. Let's look at that, you know, and let's, you know, it's just, I don't know. That's where all the criticality gets sucked up in something that, you know, we already know is in place. We already know is a problem. You know, it's already contested. It was contested before it opened. It's contested during its opening. It's contested afterwards. So let's look at what's going on there. So anyways, very naive. You know, clearly it's not unusual, the kind of critical response that the 2014 biennial received. You know, very much like 2012, you know, talking about the 2012 biennial in terms of, you know, making that fourth floor into a dance studio or performance space, right? That's how we remember 2012.
Right.
You know, which artists were there? I can't remember, but, you know, how the biennial was shaped is what we remember. So, that's how it goes. And, you know, I'm in the process of, working on the Portland Biennial, and, you know, I have 33 artists that I selected, and, you know, I naively am hoping that, the critics will start, you know, looking at, you know, the hard work that the artists
right.
have done and are working on. I'm more cautious this time and realize that there's a possibility that they will talk about, you know, the spaces or the overall, arc of the Portland Biennial as a state institution. So, yeah, there you have it.
It's a different set of writers that or reviewers that are going to be covering the Portland Biennial then. And I would imagine there's not going to be any crossover with what you would have for the Whitney. Right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, yes, to a certain point, I think Portland is curious enough, and this goes back to some of the, you know, problems of location, the idea of regionalism, all of the stuff we were talking about earlier, Michael. I think there is, the questions you were asking me are questions that, you know, not only, you know, somebody in Los Angeles like yourself are asking, but people in New York. So I think there's still a curiosity about Portland, and Portland is, it has its own ethos. It's a very specific culture here. I don't know. We'll see. Last time it was reviewed in Freeze. I don't remember if a New York magazine came out. There's a little bit of curiosity. But we're also living in a world that has great amounts of biennial fatigue. So,
right.
So we'll see.
I think it is inevitable, though, that 9 out of 10 reviews of the show, presuming it does get 10 reviews, by the way, not to make a crass comment, but is going to be 2014 Whitney Biennial curator Michelle Grabner ...
You're giving me the hard truth. Yes.
Sorry. I'm only the messenger.
You're right. So, and it's already happened. I mean, but again, this is my thing. It's like, that's fine. That we can have that conversation now. But, you know, come July 9th when, sites throughout the state of Oregon, you know, open their doors. What's inside those doors? What's inside of those spaces is hopefully what we're talking about. So I'll just keep reminding people that that's
right.
Where they should turn their attention.
Right. Good. I guess one other place that I feel it would be remiss if we didn't talk about is this cliche, or this perhaps a better word to use is lightning rod of a expression is having it all. And I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, if it's completely obvious, but you seem to, on the surface, kind of have that going on, and you can certainly break it down how that's a mirage, but just to sort of my own sort of vaguely familiar outline is that you have a family with kids and you have been able to be an artist, a reviewer, a curator, and a gallery, you know, the runner of two galleries, right? So,
yeah.
And I'm sure I'm leaving out a couple of things, but how do you do it? I don't know if that's a very interesting question, but do you have it all? And if so, are you the rare exception?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, rare exceptions. You know, first of all, like, you know, I have the same, I don't know. I think it's a sense of responsibility, and I maybe I'm turning the have it all question to, I feel a huge responsibility to discourse, to teaching, to criticism, to my own studio practice that requires a high degree of thinking, of production, of, you know, analyzing, of writing, of, you know, looking at other things. And you know, I believe so much in the language of abstraction, let's say, or criticality, that, you know, I work hard. I work hard to keep those things in focus, to constantly analyze them, to put them into, you know, contexts, thinking about my curating. And again, also having huge respect for artists, just artists in general, their ideas. And if I can make room to, you know, foreground their projects via curatorial projects like the Whitney Biennial or the Portland Biennial, or in my own artist project spaces in Milwaukee, that I will do that because I learn, right? And so, yeah, and I made it this far. I mean, this is kind of the beautiful thing. It took, you know, two mid-career and middle-aged to understand that, you know, I'm going to wake up in the morning and it may be easy that day or maybe difficult that day, but there is going to be no question I am an artist, right? And I think that as a young person, you know, there's so many vagaries that kind of push at that. You know, how again are we succeeding in all of that? So I guess I can tell you that I succeeded as an artist. Whether I'm succeeding as a good artist, that's going to be another question that we can, you know, history will kind of weigh in on. But now that I can understand, you know, who I am and the work that I do as a core, I just have great responsibility to that and have to continuously work at that. Yeah, so I don't, do I have it all? I just work really hard, Michael. You know, and you know, I trust me, my children challenge me greatly. My teaching challenges me. I'm in, you know, I'm really kind of at a very funny point now in the studio trying to figure out. I've been working on these paintings, these large scale oil paintings that I think are hugely important in terms of thinking about color, think about abstraction in 2016. You know, and they're not received in great embrace right now. And so I'm kind of puzzling through that and having to trust that, you know, I plow through that and I, you know, kind of an immediate, you know, critical response is okay. But as we all know, that's a difficult place to be in the studio, and trying to figure that out. So, yeah, does that all sound like a
backpedaling? Kinda. I think that what's implied in my question is that, you know, and I hope I don't sound like an ass, you know, saying this as a man, but
that
a lot of women, you know, struggle with the juggling of, you know, how they are going to have a career and also be a parent or a mother. It seems like even if your children are difficult or you know, critical of you at times, that you are having both of those worlds in, you know, embedded into who you are.
And I need to say this because this is very important. So I had my first kid when I was in grad school. He's now 28 and he's fine and he's just fine. But it was interesting because when I was in grad school at Northwestern, because I was pregnant, I was not taken seriously by my faculty or my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And a matter of fact, Northwestern is a free ride. So they took my money away because it was just not, I was not, you know, I remember one critic just, first of all, he didn't believe children should have access to museums. You know, so it was just, and I was so taken back by that. When I was an undergrad, I was doing a lot of work at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Child Care Center. That was kind of my day job. And, you know, so childhood development was really important to me. And in thinking about progress in the 80s in terms of, you know, women and women in their relationship to work and raising a family. So going to grad school then in the early 90s and realizing that, oh my God, within the art world, there's still this pushback in terms of what women can do and who's a serious artist. That offended me to know. I still, you know, I could not believe it, that for some reason it felt like all the progress I was identifying as an undergrad in Milwaukee, that, you know, in grad school, that was all cutting against me. And it was so offensive that, you know, I kind of got this, well, fuck you attitude where, you know, I will show them. So I would say that a lot of my drive comes from being said no to mm-hmm. As a woman, as mm-hmm. a mother, mm-hmm. You know, so that is, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily a good motivation. I don't know if I'm recommending it to others, but, you know, there were these kind of cultural shocks that I had as a very young person in my teens, thinking in the 70s, thinking that, you know, the world is going to be a great place for women and who can make choices. And when I hit these, you know, walls, I was just shocked. And unfortunately, those walls are still there. Yeah. And that is, you know, yeah, it's inexplicable. They're more prevalent, I think, than in recent past, which is a very long conversation. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's a bit of like, you've got to be kidding. I'll show you, you know, and there are feminists in positions where, you know, working extra hard or having this position is not necessarily, you know, is a problem. But it felt like my only recourse.
Right. Are either of your kids artists?
Let's see. My oldest kid is writing his dissertation on Caribbean modernism. He's in the English department. Mm. He's an academic geek. And, you know, as a parent, I'm not worried about him. He's, you know, perfectly safe. And oddly enough, as a white male, he is a minority in the field of English, of literature. My other son, who just turned 23, he's graduating next weekend, and I think it's poetry and some education. Not quite sure what that undergrad degree yielded. And then I have a lovely 11-year-old. You know, I think, it's okay that they're not artists.
No, it's better that they're not artists, isn't it?
I think that's right. It's funny. I torture my poor 11-year-old, who's a very sophisticated 11-year-old, when I would get off the train at New Haven to go see some of my grad students in the painting and printmaking department at Yale. I would always walk by the School of Nursing on the way, and I take photographs of it, and I text them to her. So it's the healthcare field. That is where I keep pointing that out to her as a possibility.
some very gently nudging. That's nice.
Yes, exactly.
Beautiful. Well, Michelle, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much.
Thank you again to Michelle for talking to us. I hope you enjoyed that. And I think if there is one question that I imagine or I could anticipate that a few people might be skeptical or annoyed by, it, it's that last question about, does she have it all? And that would be the follow-up to that would be, are you asking men that question? Why are you only asking a woman that question? Well, maybe I will ask everyone that question. Maybe that's an equal opportunity question that I will ask everyone. It's just that I haven't had a guest with somebody like Michelle's breadth or depth before. So that's kind of why it came up. I hope that's okay. Hope you can forgive me, but I will ask it in the future. It's an equal opportunity question. Guess what else? This is a listener-supported show. Your support of the show keeps it going, and that includes, I have a couple of guys that are assisting me interning for the podcast currently, and I would love to pay them a stipend from time to time, so your donations will go towards that as well as the production costs. So if you can go to theconversationpod.com/support and make a donation of $12.20 or, you know, a couple hundred dollars, that would be much appreciated if you are so inclined. You can also, of course, support the show via social media, and that includes @ArtistPodcast on Twitter and Instagram, and it means Facebook, where if you, in the near future, become that 1,000th like, you are destined for winning the raffle of an amazing trip somewhere that has yet to be determined, or something like that. In spirit. And of course, you can also leave a nice review on iTunes, which will help other people find the show. That is linked through theconversationpod.com as well. You will also, by donating to the show, by the way, be able to join the list of people who get the bonus episodes. The first one being the bonus clip with Max Maslansky, who was an episode about 4 episodes ago or so. And we have another one coming up with recent guest Amanda Yates Garcia, who is a witch as well as an artist. And that bonus clip will be top 10 cliches about a witch. Are they true or are they myths? She will answer. So your support is very much appreciated in advance. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. Do let us know what you think of this episode as well as any others. And do spread the word about the show. We very much appreciate you getting the word out there. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.